You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Kristen Hughes. The Amateur Cracksman by E. W. Horning. Willful Murder. Of the various robberies in which we were both concerned, it is not but the few, I find, that will bear telling at any length. Not that the others contain details which even I would hesitate to recount. It is, rather, the very absence of untoward incident which renders them useless for my present purposes. In point of fact, our plans were so craftily laid by Raffles that the chances of a hitch were invariably reduced to a minimum before we went to work. We might be disappointed in the market value of our haul, but it was quite the exception for us to find ourselves confronted by unforeseen impediments, or involved in a really dramatic dilemma. There was a sameness even in our spoil, for of course only the most precious stones are worth the trouble we took and the risks we ran. In short, our most successful escapades would prove the greatest weariness of all in narrative form, and none more so than the dull affair of the Ardagh Emeralds, some 8 or 9 weeks after the Milchester Cricket Week. The former, however, had a sequel that I would rather forget than all our burglaries put together. It was the evening after our return from Ireland, and I was waiting at my rooms for Raffles, who had gone off as usual to dispose of the plunder. Raffles had his own method of conducting this very vital branch of our business, which I was well content to leave entirely in his hands. He drove the bargains, I believe, in a thin but subtle disguise of the flashy seed order, and always in the Cockney dialect, of which he had made himself a master. Moreover, he invariably employed the same fence, who was ostensibly a money-lender in a small, but yet notorious way, and in reality a rascal as remarkable as Raffles himself. Only lately I had also been to the man, but in my proper person. We had needed capital for the getting of these very emeralds, and I had raised £100, on the terms you would expect, from a soft-spoken greybeard, with an ingratiating smile, an incessant bow, and the shiftiest old eyes that ever flew from rim to rim of a pair of spectacles. So the original sinews and the final spoils of war came in this case from the self-same source, a circumstance which appealed to us both. But these same final spoils I was still to see, and I waited and waited with an impatience that grew upon me with the growing dusk. At my open window I had played Sister Anne until the faces in the street below were no longer distinguishable, and now I was tearing to and fro in the grip of horrible hypotheses, a grip that tightened when at last the lift-gates opened with a clatter outside, that held me breathless until a well-known tattoo followed on my door. "In the dark?" said Raffles as I dragged him in. "Why, Bunny, what's wrong?" "Nothing, now you've come," said I, shutting the door behind him in a fever of relief and anxiety. "Well, well, what did they fetch?"
"500."
"Down?"
"Got it in my pocket."
"Good man," I cried. "You don't know what a stew I've been in. I'll switch on the light. I've been thinking of you and nothing else for the last hour.
I was ass enough to think something had gone wrong.
Raffles was smiling when the white light filled the room, but for the moment I did not perceive the peculiarity of his smile. I was fatuously full of my own late tremors and present relief, and my first idiotic act was to spill some whiskey and squirt the soda-water all over in my anxiety, to do instant justice to the occasion.
"So you thought something had happened?"
said Raffles, leaning back in my chair as he lit a cigarette, and looking much amused.
"What would you say if something had? Sit tight, my dear chap. It was nothing of the slightest consequence, and it's all over now. A stern chase and a long one, Bunny, but I think I'm well to windward this time."
And suddenly I saw that his collar was limp, his hair matted, his boots thick with dust. "The police?" I whispered aghast.
"Oh, dear, no. Only old Baird."
"Baird? But wasn't it Baird who took the emeralds?"
"It was."
"Then how came he to chase you?"
"My dear fellow, I'll tell you if you give me a chance. It's really nothing to get in the least excited about. Old Baird has at last spotted that I'm not quite the common cracksman I would have him think me, so he's been doing his best to run me to my burrow."
"And you call that nothing?"
"It would be something if he had succeeded, but he has still to do that. I admit, however, that he made me sit up for the time being. It all comes of going on the job so far from home. There was the old brute with the whole thing in his morning paper. He knew it must have been done by some fellow who could pass himself off for a gentleman, and I saw his eyebrows go up the moment I told him I was the man, with the same old twang that you could cut with a paper knife. I did my best to get out of it, swore I had a pal who was a real swell, but I saw very plainly that I had given myself away. He gave up haggling, he paid my price as though he enjoyed it, but I felt him follow me when I made tracks, though of course I didn't turn round to see."
"Why not?"
"My dear Bunny, it's the very worst thing you can do. As long as you look unsuspecting, they'll keep their distance. And so long as they keep their distance, you stand a chance. Once show that you know you're being followed, and it's flight or fight for all you're worth. I never even looked round, and mind you never do in the same hole. I just hurried up to Blackfriars and booked for High Street, Kensington, at the top of my voice, and as the train was leaving Sloane Square, out I hopped, and up all those streets like a lamplighter, and round to the studio by the back streets. Well, to be on the safe side, I lay low there all the afternoon, hearing nothing in the least suspicious, and only wishing I had a window to look through instead of that beastly skylight. However, the coast seemed clear enough, and thus far it was my mere idea that he would follow me. There was nothing to show he had. So at last I marched out in my proper rig, almost straight into old Bard's arms."
"What on earth did you do?"
"Walked past him as though I'd never set eyes on him in my life, and didn't then. Took a hansom in the King's Road, and drove like a deuce to Clapham Junction. Rushed on to the nearest platform without a ticket, jumped on to the first train I saw, got out at Twickenham, walked full tilt back to Richmond, took the district to Charing Cross, and here I am. Ready for a tub and a change, and the best dinner the club can give us. I came to you first because I thought you might be getting anxious. Come round with me, and I won't keep you long."
"You're certain you've given him the slip?" I said as we put on our hats.
"Certain enough, but we can make assurance doubly sure," said Raffles,
and went to my window, where he stood for a moment or two looking down in the street. "All right?" I asked him.
"All right,"
said he, and we went downstairs forthwith, and so to the Albany, arm in arm. But we were both rather silent on our way. I, for my part, was wondering what Raffles would do about the studio in Chelsea, whither, at all events, he had been successfully dogged. To me the point seemed one of immediate importance, but when I mentioned it he said there was time enough to think about that. His one other remark was made after we had nodded, in Bond Street, to a young blood of our acquaintance who happened to be getting himself a bad name.
"Poor Jack Rutter," said Raffles with a sigh. "Nothing sadder than to see a fellow going to the bad like that. He's about mad with drink and debt, poor devil. Did you see his eye? Odd that we should have met him to-night, by the way. It's old Baird who's said to have skinned him. By God, but I'd like to skin old Baird!"
And his tone took a sudden low fury, made the more noticeable by another long silence, which lasted, indeed, throughout an admirable dinner at the club, and for some time after we had settled down in a quiet corner of the smoking-room with our coffee and cigars. Then at last I saw Raffles looking at me with his lazy smile, and I knew that the morose fit was at an end.
"I dare say you wonder what I've been thinking about all this time," said he. "I've been thinking what rot it is to go doing things by halves."
"Well," said I, returning his smile, "that's not a charge that you can bring against yourself, is it?"
"I'm not so sure," said Raffles, blowing a meditative puff. "As a matter of fact, I was thinking less of myself than of that poor devil of Jack Rutter. There's a fellow who does things by halves. He's only half gone to the bad, and look at the difference between him and us. He's under the thumb of a villainous moneylender. We are solvent citizens. He's taken to drink. We're as sober as we are solvent. His pals are begging to cut him. Our difficulty is to keep the pal from the door. Enfin, he begs and borrows, which is stealing by halves, and we steal outright and are done with it. Obviously ours is the more honest course. Yet I'm not sure, Bunny, but we're doing the thing by halves ourselves."
"Why, what more could we do?" I exclaimed in soft derision, looking round, however, to make sure that we were not overheard.
"What more?" said Raffles. "Well, murder, for one thing."
"Rot!"
"A matter of opinion, my dear Bunny. I don't mean it for rot. I've told you before that the biggest man alive is the man who's committed a murder and not yet been found out. At least he ought to be, but he so very seldom has the soul to appreciate himself. Just think of it. Think of coming in here and talking to the men, very likely about the murder itself, and knowing you've done it, and wondering how they'd look if they knew. Oh, it would be great, simply great. But besides all that, when you were caught, there'd be a merciful and dramatic end of you. You'd fill the bill for a few weeks, and then snuff out with a flourish of extra specials. You wouldn't rust with a vile repose for 7 or 14 years.
"Good old Raffles," I chuckled. "I begin to forgive you for being in bad form at dinner."
"But I was never more earnest in my life."
"Go on."
"I mean it."
"You know very well that you wouldn't commit a murder, whatever else you might do."
"I know very well I'm going to commit one tonight."
He had been leaning back in the saddlebag chair, watching me with keen eyes sheathed by languid lids. Now he started forward, and his eyes leapt to mine like cold steel from the scabbard. They struck home to my slow wits. Their meaning was no longer in doubt. I, who knew the man, read murder in his clenched hands, and murder in his locked lips. But 100 murders in those hard blue eyes.
"Baird?"
I faltered, moistening my lips with my tongue.
"Of course."
"But you said it didn't matter about the room in Chelsea."
"I told a lie."
"Anyway, you gave him the slip afterwards."
"That was another. I didn't. I thought I had when I came up to you this evening, but when I looked out of your window—you remember? To make assurance doubly sure—there he was on the opposite pavement down below."
"And you never said a word about it?"
"I wasn't going to spoil your dinner, Bunny. I wasn't going to let you spoil mine. And there he was as large as life, and of course he followed us to the Albany. A fine game for him to play. A game after his mean old heart. Blackmail from me, bribes from the police, and one bidding against the other. But he shan't play it with me, he shan't live to, and the world will have an extortioner the less. Waiter, 2 Scotch whiskies and sodas. I'm off at 11, Bunny. It's the only thing to be done."
"You know where he lives, then?"
"Yes, out Willesden way, and alone. The fellow's a miser, among other things. I long ago found out all about him."
Again I looked round the room. It was a young man's club, and young men were laughing, chatting, smoking, drinking, on every hand. One nodded to me through the smoke. Like a machine, I nodded to him and turned back to Raffles with a groan.
"Surely you will give him a chance," I urged. "The very sight of your pistol should bring him to terms."
"It wouldn't make him keep them."
"But you might try the effect."
"I probably shall. Here's a drink for you, Bunny. Wish me luck."
"I'm coming, too."
"I don't want you."
"But I must come."
An ugly gleam shot from the steel-blue eyes. "To interfere?" said Raffles.
"Not I."
"You give me your word?"
"I do."
"Bunny, if you break it, you may shoot me, too." "I most certainly should," said Raffles solemnly. "So you come at your own peril, my dear man. But if you are coming, well, the sooner the better, for I must stop at my rooms on the way."
5 minutes later I was waiting for him at the Piccadilly entrance to the Albany. I had reason for remaining outside. It was the feeling, half hope, half fear, that Angus Baird might still be on our trail, that some more immediate and less cold-blooded way of dealing with him might result from a sudden encounter between the moneylender and myself. I would not warn him of his danger, but I would avert tragedy at all costs. And when no such encounter had taken place, and Raffles and I were fairly on our way to Willesden, that, I think, was still my honest resolve. I would not break my word if I could help it, but it was a comfort to feel that I could break it if I liked, on an understood penalty. Alas, I fear my good intentions were tainted with a devouring curiosity, and overlaid by the fascination which goes hand in hand with horror. I have a poignant recollection of the hour it took us to reach the house. We walked across St. James's Park. I can see the lights now, bright on the bridge and blurred in the water. And we had some minutes to wait for the last train to Willesden. It left at 11:21, I remember, and Raffles was put out to find it did not go on to Kensal Rise. We had to get out at Willesden Junction and walk on through the streets into fairly open country that happened to be quite new to me. I could never find the house again. I remember, however, that we were on a dark footpath between woods and fields when the clocks began striking 12. "Surely," said I, "we shall find him in bed and asleep."
"I hope we do," said Raffles grimly.
"Then you mean to break in?"
"What else did you think?"
I had not thought about it at all. The ultimate crime had monopolized my mind. Beside it, burglary was a bagatelle, but one to depreciate nonetheless. I saw obvious objections. The man was au fait with cracksmen and their ways. He would certainly have firearms, and might be the first to use them.
"I could wish nothing better," said Raffles. "Then it will be man to man, and devil take the worst shot. You don't suppose I prefer foul play to fair, do you? But die he must, by one or the other, or it's a long stretch for you and me."
"Better that than this."
"Then stay where you are, my good fellow. I told you I didn't want you, and this is the house, so good night."
I could see no house at all, only the angle of a high wall rising solitary in the night, with the starlight glittering on battlements of broken glass, and in the wall a tall green gate, bristling with spikes, and showing a front for battering-rams in the feeble rays an outlying lamp-post cast across the new-made road. It seemed to me a road of building sites, with but this one house built all by itself at one end. But the night was too dark for more than a mere impression. Raffles, however, had seen the place by daylight, and had come prepared for the special obstacles. Already he was reaching up and putting champagne corks on the spikes, and in another moment he had his folded covert coat across the corks. I stepped back as he raised himself, and saw a little pyramid of slates snip the sky above the gate. As he squirmed over, I ran forward, and had my own weight on the spikes and corks and covert coat when he gave the latter a tug.
"Coming after all?"
"Rather."
"Take care, then. This place is all bell-wires and springs. It's no soft thing, this. There, stand still while I take off the corks."
The garden was very small and new, with a grass plot still in separate sods, but a quantity of full-grown laurel stuck into the raw clay beds. bells in themselves, as Raffle whispered. There's nothing else rustles so, cunning old beast. And we gave them a wide berth as we crept across the grass.
He's gone to bed.
I don't think so, Bunny. I believe he's seen us.
Why?
I saw a light.
Where?
Downstairs, for an instant, when I... His whisper died away. He had seen the light again, and so had I. It lay like a golden rod under the front door and vanished. It reappeared like a golden thread under the lintel and vanished for good. We heard the stairs creak, creak and cease. Also for good. We neither saw nor heard any more, though we stood waiting on the grass till our feet were soaked with the dew.
"I'm going in," said Raffles at last. "I don't believe he saw us at all. I wish he had. This way."
We trod gingerly on the path, but the gravel stuck to our wet soles and grated horribly in a little tiled veranda with a glass door leading within. It was through this glass that Raffles had first seen the light, and now he proceeded to take out a pane, with the diamond, the pot of treacle, and the sheet of brown paper which was seldom omitted from his impedimenta. Nor did he dispense with my own assistance, though he may have accepted it as instinctively as it was proffered. In any case, it was these fingers that helped to spread the treacle on the brown paper, and pressed the latter to the glass until the diamond had completed its circuit and the pane fell gently back into our hands. Raffles now inserted his hand, turned the key in the lock, and by making a long arm succeeded in drawing the bolt at the bottom of the door. It proved to be the only one, and the door opened, though not very wide.
"What's that?"
said Raffles, as something crunched beneath his feet on the very threshold.
"A pair of spectacles," I whispered, picking them up.
I was still fingering the broken lenses and the bent rims when Raffles tripped and almost fell, with a gasping cry that he made no effort to restrain.
"Hush, man, hush!"
I entreated under my breath.
"He'll hear you!"
For answer his teeth chattered, even his, and I heard him fumbling with his matches.
"No, Bunny, he won't hear us,"
whispered Raffles presently, and he rose from his knees and lit a gas as the match burnt down. Angus Baird was lying on his own floor, dead, with his grey hairs glued together by his blood. Near him a poker, with the black end glistening, in a corner of his desk, ransacked, littered. A clock ticked noisily on the chimney-piece. For perhaps 100 seconds, there was no other sound. Raffles stood very still, staring down at the dead, as a man might stare into an abyss after striding blindly to its brink. His breath came audibly through the wide nostrils. He made no other sign, and his lips seemed sealed.
"That light," said I hoarsely. "The light we saw under the door."
With a start he turned to me.
"It's true. I had forgotten it. It was in here I saw it first."
"He must be upstairs still."
"If he is, we'll soon rout him out. Come on."
Instead, I laid a hand upon his arm, imploring him to reflect that his enemy was dead now, that we should certainly be involved, that now or never was our own time to escape. He shook me off in a sudden fury of impatience, a reckless contempt in his eyes, and bidding me save my own skin if I liked, he once more turned his back upon me, and this time left me half resolved to take him at his word. Had he forgotten on what errand he himself was here? Was he determined that this night should end in black disaster? As I asked myself these questions, his match flared in the hall. In another moment the stairs were creaking under his feet, even as they had creaked under those of the murderer, and the humane instinct that inspired him in defiance of his risk was borne in also upon my slower sensibilities. Could we let the murderer go? My answer was to bound up the creaking stairs and to overhaul Raffles on the landing. But three doors presented themselves. The first opened into a bedroom with the bed turned down but undisturbed. The second room was empty in every sense. The third door was locked. Raffles lit the landing gas.
"He's in there," said he, cocking his revolver. "Do you remember how we used to break into the studies at school? Here goes."
His flat foot crashed over the keyhole. The lock gave.
The door flew open, and in the sudden draught the landing gas heeled over like a cobble in a squall. As the flame righted itself, I saw a fixed bath, two bath towels knotted together, an open window, a cowering figure, and Raffles struck aghast on the threshold.
"Jack Rutter?"
The words came thick and slow with horror, and in horror I heard myself repeating them, while the cowering figure by the bathroom window rose gradually erect.
"It's you!"
he whispered, in amazement no less than our own.
"It's you two! What's it mean, Raffles? I saw you get over the gate. A bell rang. The place is full of them."
"Then you broke in. What's it all mean?"
"We may tell you that when you tell us what in God's name you've done, Rutter."
"Done? What have I done?" The unhappy wretch came out into the light with bloodshot, blinking eyes and a bloody shirt front.
"You know. You've seen. But I'll tell you if you like. I've killed a robber, that's all. I've killed a robber, a usurer, a jackal, a blackmailer, the cleverest and cruelest villain unhung. I'm ready to hang for him. I'd kill him again."
And he looked us fiercely in the face, a fine defiance in his dissipated eyes, his breast heaving, his jaw like a rock.
"Shall I tell you how it happened?"
he went passionately on.
"He's made my life a hell these weeks and months past. You may know that. A perfect hell. Well, tonight I met him in Bond Street. Do you remember when I met you fellows? He wasn't 20 yards behind you. He was on your tracks, Raffles. He saw me nod to you and stopped me and asked me who you were. He seemed as keen as knives to know. I couldn't think why, and didn't care either, for I saw my chance. I said I'd tell him all about you if he'd give me a private interview. He said he wouldn't. I said he should, and held him by the coat. By the time I let him go you were out of sight, and I waited where I was till he came back in despair. I had the whip hand of him then. I could dictate where the interview should be, and I made him take me home with him, still swearing to tell him all about you when we'd had our talk. Well, when we got here I made him give me something to eat, putting him off and off, and about 10 o'clock I heard the gate shut. I waited a bit, and then asked him if he lived alone. "Not at all," says he. "Did you not see the servant?"
I said I'd seen her, but I thought I'd heard her go. If I was mistaken, no doubt she would come when she was called. And I yelled 3 times at the top of my voice. Of course, there was no servant to come. I knew that, because I came to see him one night last week, and he interviewed me himself through the gate, but wouldn't open it. Well, when I had done yelling and not a soul had come near us, he was as white as that ceiling. Then I told him we could have our chat at last, and I picked up the poker out of the fender, and told him how he'd robbed me. But by God, he shouldn't rob me any more. I gave him 3 minutes to write and sign a settlement of all his iniquitous claims against me, or have his brains beaten out over his own carpet. He thought a minute, and then went to his desk for pen and paper. In 2 seconds he was round like lightning with a revolver, and I went for him bald-headed. He fired 2 or 3 times and missed. You can find the holes if you like. But I hit him every time. My God! I was like a savage till the thing was done. And then I didn't care. I went through his desk looking for my own bills, and was coming away when you turned up. I said I didn't care, nor do I. But I was going to give myself up tonight, and shall still. So you see I shan't give you fellows much trouble."
He was done. And there we stood on the landing of the lonely house, the low, thick, eager voice still racing and ringing through our ears, the dead man below, and in front of us his impenitent slayer. I knew to whom the impenitence would appeal when he had heard the story, and I was not mistaken.
"That's all rot," said Raffles, speaking after a pause. "We shan't let you give yourself up."
"You shan't stop me. What would be the good? The woman saw me. It would only be a question of time, and I can't face waiting to be taken. Think of it, waiting for them to touch you on the shoulder. No, 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 I'll give myself up and get it over." His speech was changed. He faltered, he floundered. It was as though a clearer perception of his position had come with the bare idea of escape from it.
"But listen to me," urged Raffles. We're here at our peril ourselves. We broke in like thieves to enforce redress for a grievance very like your own. But don't you see? We took out a pane. Did the thing like regular burglars. Regular burglars will get the credit for all the rest.
You mean I shan't be suspected?
I do.
But I don't want to get off scot-free, cried Rutter hysterically. I've killed him, I know that. But it was in self-defense, it wasn't murder. I must own up and take the consequence. I shall go mad if I don't.
His hands twitched, his lips quivered, the tears were in his eyes. Raffles took him roughly by the shoulder.
Look here, you fool! If the three of us were caught here now, do you know what those consequences would be? We should swing in a row at Newgate in 6 weeks' time. You talk as though we were sitting in a club. Don't you know it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and the lights on, and a dead man down below? For God's sake, pull yourself together and do what I tell you, or you're a dead man yourself.
I wish I was one, Rutter sobbed. I wish I had his revolver to blow my own brains out. It's lying under him. Oh, my God, my God!
His knees knocked together. The frenzy of reaction was at its height. We had to take him downstairs between us, and so through the front door and out into the open air. All was still outside, all but the smothered weeping of the unstrung wretch upon our hands. Raffles returned for a moment to the house. Then all was dark as well. The gate opened from within. We closed it carefully behind us, and so left the starlight shining on broken glass and polished spikes, one and all as we had found them. We escaped. No need to dwell on our escape. Our murderer seemed set upon the scaffold, drunk with his deed. He was more trouble than 6 men drunk with wine. Again and again we threatened to leave him to his fate, to wash our hands of him. But incredible and unmerited luck was with the three of us. Not a soul did we meet between that and Willesden. And of those who saw us later, did one think of the 2 men with crooked white ties, supporting a third in a seemingly unmistakable condition, when the evening papers apprised the town of a terrible tragedy at Kensal Rise? We walked to Maida Vale, and then strove openly to my rooms. But I alone went upstairs. The other two proceeded to the Albany, and I saw no more of Raffles for 48 hours. He was not at his rooms when I called in the morning. He had left no word. When he reappeared, the papers were full of the murder, and the man who had committed it was on the wide Atlantic, a steerage passenger from Liverpool to New York.
There was no arguing with him, so Raffles told me. Either he must make a clean breast of it or flee the country. So I rigged him up at the studio, and we took the first train to Liverpool. Nothing would induce him to sit tight and enjoy the situation as I should have endeavoured to do in his place. And it's just as well. I went to his diggings and destroyed some papers. And what do you think I found? The police in possession. There's a warrant out against him already. The idiots think that window wasn't genuine and the warrant's out. It won't be my fault if it's ever served.
Nor, after all these years, can I think it will be mine. End of Willful Murder.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Kristen Hughes. The Amateur Cracksman by E. W. Horning. 9 points of the Law.
Well, said Raffles, what do you make of it?
I read the advertisement once more before replying. It was in the last column of the Daily Telegraph, and it ran, £2,000 reward. The above sum may be earned by anyone qualified to undertake delicate mission and prepared to run certain risk. Apply by telegram, Security, London.
I think, said I, it's the most extraordinary advertisement that ever got into print.
Raffles smiled.
Not quite all that, Bunny. Still extraordinary enough, I grant you.
Look at the figure,
"It is certainly large."
"And the mission and the risk!"
"Yes, the combination is frank, to say the least of it. But the really original point is requiring applications by telegram to a telegraphic address. There's something in the fellow who thought of that, and something in his game. With one word he chokes off the million who answer an advertisement every day, when they can raise the stamp. My answer cost me 5 bob. But then I prepaid another."
"You don't mean to say that you've applied?"
"Rather," said Raffles. "I want £2,000 as much as any man."
"Put your own name?"
"Well, no, Bunny, I didn't. In point of fact, I smell something interesting and illegal. And you know what a cautious chap I am. I signed myself Glasspool, care of Hickey, 38 Conduit Street. That's my tailor. And after sending the wire, I went round and told him what to expect. He promised to send the reply along the moment it came. I shouldn't be surprised if that's it."
And he was gone before a double knock on the outer door had done ringing through the rooms, to return next minute with an open telegram and a face full of news.
"What do you think?" said he. "Security is that fellow Addenbrooke, the police court lawyer, and he wants to see me instanter."
"You know him, then?"
"Merely by repute. I only hope he doesn't know me. He's the chap who got 6 weeks for sailing too close to the wind in the Sutton Wilmer case. Everybody wondered why he wasn't struck off the rolls. Instead of that, he's got a first-rate practice on the seamy side, and every blackguard with half a case takes it straight to Bennett Addenbrooke. He's probably the one man who would have the cheek to put in an advertisement like that, and the one man who could do it without exciting suspicion. It's simply in his line. But you may be sure there's something shady at the bottom of it. The odd thing is that I have long made up my mind to go to Addenbrooke myself if accidents should happen."
"And you're going to him now?"
"This minute,"
said Raffles, brushing his hat.
"And so are you."
"But I came in to drag you out to lunch."
"You shall lunch with me when we've seen this fellow. Come on, Bunny. We'll choose your name on the way. Mine's Glasspool, and don't you forget it."
Mr. Bennett Addenbrooke occupied substantial offices in Wellington Street, Strand, and was out when we arrived. But he had only just gone over the way to the court, and 5 minutes sufficed to produce a brisk, fresh-coloured, resolute-looking man, with a very confident, rather festive air, and black eyes that opened wide at the sight of Raffles.
"Mr. Glasspool?" exclaimed the lawyer. "My name," said Raffles with dry effrontery. "Not up at Lord's, however," said the other slyly. "My dear sir, I have seen you take far too many wickets to make any mistake."
For a single moment Raffles looked venomous. Then he shrugged and smiled, and the smile grew into a cynical little chuckle.
"So you have bowled me out in my turn," said he. "Well, I don't think there's anything to explain. I am harder up than I wish to admit under my own name, that's all. And I want that £1,000 reward."
2,000, said the solicitor.
"And the man who is not above an alias happens to be just the sort of man I want. So don't let that worry you, my dear sir.
The matter, however, is of a strictly private and confidential character." And he looked very hard at me.
"Quite so," said Raffles. "But there was something about a risk. A certain risk is involved." "Then surely three heads will be better than two. I said I wanted that £1,000. My friend here wants the other. We are both cursedly hard up, and we go into this thing together or not at all. Must you have his name, too? I should give him my real one, Bunny."
Mr. Addenbrooke raised his eyebrows over the card I found for him. Then he drummed upon it with his fingernail, and his embarrassment expressed itself in a puzzled smile. "The fact is, I find myself in a difficulty," he confessed at last. "Yours is the first reply I have received. People who can afford to send long telegrams don't rush to the advertisements in the Daily Telegraph. But on the other hand, I was not quite prepared to hear from men like yourselves. Candidly, and on consideration,
I am not sure that you are the stamp of men for me, men who belong to good clubs. I rather intended to appeal to the, adventurous classes."
"We are adventurers," said Raffles gravely.
"But you respect the law."
The black eyes gleamed shrewdly.
"We are not professional rogues, if that's what you mean," said Raffles, smiling. "But on our beam ends we are. We would do a good deal for £1,000 apiece, eh, Bunny?"
"Anything," I murmured. The solicitor rapped his desk. "I'll tell you what I want you to do. You can but refuse. It's illegal, but it's a legality in a good cause. That's the risk, and my client is prepared to pay for it. He will pay for the attempt in case of failure. The money is as good as yours once you consent to run the risk. My client is Sir Bernard Debenham, of Brook Hall, Esher."
"I know his son," I remarked.
Raffles knew him too, but said nothing, and his eye drooped disapproval in my direction. Bennett Addenbrook turned to me.
"Then," said he, "you have the privilege of knowing one of the most complete young blackguards about town, and the fond et origo of the whole trouble. As you know the son, you may know the father too, at all events by reputation, and in that case I needn't tell you that he is a very peculiar man. He lives alone in a storehouse of treasures which no eyes but his ever behold. He is said to have the finest collection of pictures in the south of England, though nobody ever sees them to judge. Pictures, fiddles, and furniture are his hobby, and he is undoubtedly very eccentric. Nor can one deny that there has been considerable eccentricity in his treatment of his son. For years Sir Bernard paid his debts, and the other day, without the slightest warning, not only refused to do so any more, but absolutely stopped the lad's allowance. Well, I'll tell you what has happened, but first of all you must know, or you may remember, that I appeared for young Debenham in a little scrape he got into a year or two ago. I got him off all right, and Sir Bernard paid me handsomely on the nail, and no more did I hear or see of them until one day last week."
The lawyer drew his chair nearer ours, and leaned forward with a hand on either knee. "On Tuesday of last week I had a telegram from Sir Bernard. I was to go to him at once. I found him waiting for me in the drive. Without a word he led me to the picture gallery, which was locked and darkened, drew up a blind, and stood simply pointing to an empty picture frame. It was a long time before I could get a word out of him. Then at last he told me that that frame had contained one of the rarest and most valuable pictures in England, in the world, an original Velázquez." "I have checked this," said the lawyer, "and it seems literally true. The picture was a portrait of the Infanta Maria Theresa, said to be one of the artist's greatest works, only second to another portrait of one of the popes in Rome, so they told me at the National Gallery, where they have its history by heart. They say there that the picture is practically priceless, and young Debenham has sold it for £5,000.
"The deuce he has!" said Raffles.
I inquired who had bought it.
"A Queensland legislator of the name of Craggs, the Honourable John Montague Craggs, M.L.C., to give him his full title. Not that we knew anything about him on Tuesday last. We didn't even know for certain that young Debenham had stole the picture. But he had gone down for money on the Monday evening, had been refused, and it was plain enough that he had helped himself in this way. He had threatened revenge, and this was it. Indeed, when I hunted him up in town on the Tuesday night, he confessed as much in the most brazen manner imaginable. But he wouldn't tell me who was the purchaser, and finding out took the rest of the week. But I did find out, and a nice time I've had of it ever since. Backwards and forwards between Esher and the Metropole, where the Queenslander is staying, sometimes twice a day, threats, offers, prayers, entreaties. Not one of them a bit of good."
"But," said Raffles, "surely it's a clear case. The sale was illegal. You can pay him back his money and force him to give the picture up."
"Exactly, but not without an action and a public scandal. and that my client declines to face. He would rather lose even his picture than have the whole thing get into the papers. He has disowned his son, but he will not disgrace him. Yet his picture he must have by hook or crook, and there's the rub. I am to get it back by fair means or foul. He gives me carte blanche in the matter, and, I verily believe, would throw in a bank check if asked. He offered one to the Queenslander, but Craig simply tore it in two. The one old boy is as much a character as the other, and between the two of them I'm at my wit's end.
"So you put that advertisement in the paper?"
said Raffles, in the dry tones he had adopted throughout the interview. "As a last resort, I did."
"And you wish us to steal this picture?"
It was magnificently said. The lawyer flushed from his hair to his collar.
"I knew you were not the men," he groaned.
"I never thought of men of your stamp, but it's not stealing," he exclaimed heatedly. "It's recovering stolen property. Besides, Sir Bernard will pay him his 5,000 as soon as he has the picture, and you'll see, old Craggs will be just as loath to let it come out as Sir Bernard himself. No, no, it's an enterprise, an adventure if you like, but not stealing."
"You yourself mentioned the law,"
murmured Raffles. "And the risk," I added.
"We pay for that," he said once more. "But not enough," said Raffles, shaking his head. "My good sir, consider what it means to us. You spoke of those clubs. We should not only get kicked out of them, but put in prison like common burglars. It's true we're hard up, but it simply isn't worth it at the price. Double your stakes, and I for one am your man."
Addenbrook wavered. "Do you think we could bring it off?"
"We could try."
"But you have no—"
"Experience? Well, hardly."
"And you would really run the risk for 4,000 pounds? Raffles looked at me. I nodded.
"We would," said he, "and blow the odds."
"It's more than I can ask my client to pay," said Addenbrook, growing firm.
"Then it's more than you can expect us to risk."
"You are in earnest?"
"God wot!"
"Say 3,000 if you succeed."
4 is our figure, Mr. Addenbrook."
"Then I think it should be nothing if you fail."
"Double acquits?"
cried Raffles.
"Well, that's sporting. Done!"
Addenbrook opened his lips, half rose, then sat back in his chair, and looked long and shrewdly at Raffles, never once at me.
"I know you're bowling," he said reflectively. "I go up to Lord's whenever I want an hour's real rest, and I've seen you bowl again and again. Yes, and take the best wickets in England on a plumb pitch. I don't forget the last gentleman and players. I was there. You're up to every trick, every one. I'm inclined to think that if anybody could bowl out this old Australian—"
"Damn, I believe you're my very man." The bargain was clinched at the Café Royal, where Bennett Addenbrook insisted on playing host at an extravagant luncheon. I remember that he took his whack of champagne with the nervous freedom of a man at high pressure, and have no doubt I kept him in countenance by an equal indulgence. But Raffles, ever an exemplar in such matters, was more abstemious even than his wont, and very poor company to boot. I can see him now, his eyes in his plate, thinking, thinking. I can see the solicitor, glancing from him to me, in an apprehension of which I did my best to disabuse him by my reassuring looks. At the close Raffle apologized for his preoccupation, called for an ABC timetable, and announced his intention of catching the 3:20 to Esher.
"You must excuse me, Mr. Addenbrook," said he, "but I have my own idea, and for the moment I should much prefer to keep it to myself. It may end in fizzle, so I would rather not speak about it to either of you just yet. But speak to Sir Bernard I must. So will you write me one line to him on your card? Of course, if you wish, you must come down with me and hear what I say, but I really don't see much point in it."
and as usual Raffles had his way. Though Bennett Addenbrooke showed some temper when he was gone, and I myself shared his annoyance to no small extent, I could only tell him that it was in the nature of Raffles to be self-willed and secretive, but that no man of my acquaintance had half his audacity and determination, that I, for my part, would trust him through and through, and let him gang his own gait every time. More I dared not say, even to remove those chill misgivings with which I knew that the lawyer went his way. That day I saw no more of Raffles, but a telegram reached me when I was dressing for dinner. "Be in your rooms tomorrow from noon, and keep rest of day clear. Raffles." It had been sent off from Waterloo at 6:42. So Raffles was back in town. At an earlier stage of our relations I should have hunted him up then and there, but now I knew better. His telegram meant that he had no desire for my society that night, or the following forenoon, that when he wanted me I should see him soon enough. And see him I did. Towards 1 o'clock next day, I was watching for him from my window in Mount Street, when he drove up furiously in a hansom, and jumped out without a word to the man. I met him next minute at the lift gates, and he fairly pushed me back into my rooms.
"5 minutes, Bunny," he cried, "not a moment more,"
and he tore off his coat before flinging himself into the nearest chair.
"I'm fairly on the rush," he panted, "having the very devil of a time. Not a word till I tell you all I've done. I settled my plan of campaign yesterday at lunch. The first thing was to get in with this man Craggs. You can't break into a place like the Metropole. It's got to be done from the inside. Problem one, how to get at the fellow. Only one sort of pretext would do. It must be something to do with this blessed picture, so I might see where he got it and all that. Well, I couldn't go and ask to see it out of curiosity, and I couldn't go as a second representative of the other old chap. And it was thinking how I could go that made me such a bear at lunch. But I saw my way before we got up. If I could only lay hold of a copy of the picture, I might ask leave to go and compare it with the original. So down I went to Esher to find out if there was a copy in existence, and was at Broomhall for 1 hour and a half yesterday afternoon. There was no copy there, but they must exist, for Sir Bernard himself, there's copy there, has allowed a couple to be made since the picture has been in his possession. He hunted up the painters' addresses, and the rest of the evening I spent in hunting up the painters themselves. But their work had been done on commission. One copy had gone out of the country, and I'm still on the track of the other."
"Then you haven't seen Craggs yet?"
"Seen him and made friends with him. And, if possible, he's the funnier old cuss of the two. But you should study 'em both. I took the bull by the horns this morning, went in and lied like Ananias. And it was just as well I did. The old ruffian sails for Australia by tomorrow's boat. I told him a man wanted to sell me a copy of the celebrated Infanta Maria Teresa of Velasquez, that I'd been down to the supposed owner of the picture, only to find that he had just sold it to him. You should have seen his face when I told him that. He grinned all round his wicked old head. 'Did old Debenham admit the sale?' says he. And when I said he had, he chuckled to himself for about 5 minutes. He was so pleased that he did just what I hoped he would do. He showed me the great picture. Luckily, it isn't by any means a large one. Also, the case he's got it in. It's an iron map case in which he brought over the plans of his land in Brisbane. He wants to know who would suspect it of containing an old master, too. He's had it fitted with a new Chubb's lock, and I managed to take an interest in the key while he was gloating over the canvas. I had the wax in the palm of my hand, and I shall make my duplicate this afternoon."
Raffles looked at his watch and jumped up, saying he had given me a minute too much.
"By the way," he added, "you've got to dine with him at the Metropole tonight."
"I?"
"Yes, don't look so scared. Both of us are invited. I swore you were dining with me. I accepted for us both. But I shan't be there."
His clear eye was upon me, bright with meaning and with mischief. I implored him to tell me what his meaning was.
"You will dine in his private sitting-room," said Raffles. "It adjoins his bedroom, You must keep him sitting as long as possible, Bunny, and talking all the time.
In a flash I saw his plan. You're going for the picture while we're at dinner.
I am.
And if he hears you?
He shan't.
But if he does? And I fairly trembled at the thought.
If he does, said Raffles, there will be a collision, that's all. Revolver would be out of place in the Metropole, but I shall certainly take a life-preserver.
But it's ghastly, I cried, to sit and talk to an utter stranger, and to know that you're at work in the next room.
2,000 apiece, said Raffles quietly.
Upon my soul, I believe I shall give it away.
Not you, Bunny. I know you better than you know yourself.
He put on his coat and hat. What time have I to be there? I asked him with a groan.
7:45. There will be a telegram from me saying I can't turn up. He's a terror to talk. You'll have no difficulty in keeping the ball rolling, but head him off his picture for all you're worth. If he offers to show it to you, say you must go. He locked up the case elaborately this afternoon, and there's no earthly reason why he should unlock it again in this hemisphere.
Where shall I find you when I get away?
I shall be down at Esher. Hope to catch the 9:55.
But surely I can see you again this afternoon, I cried in a ferment, for his hand was on the door. I'm not half coached up yet. I know I shall make a mess of it.
Not you,
he said again.
But I shall if I waste any more time. I've got a deuce of a lot of rushing about to do yet. You won't find me at my rooms. Why not come down to Esher yourself by the last train? That's it. Down you come with the latest news. I'll tell old Debenham to expect you. He shall give us both a bed. By Jove, he won't be able to do us too well if he's got his picture.
If, I groaned as he nodded his adieu, and then left me limp with apprehension, sick with fear, in a perfectly pitiable condition of pure stage fright. For after all, I had only to act my part, unless Raffles failed where he never did fail, unless Raffles, the neat and noiseless, was for once clumsy and inept. All I had to do was indeed to smile and smile and be a villain. I practiced that smile half the afternoon. I rehearsed putative parts in hypothetical conversations. I got up stories. I dipped in a book on Queensland at the club. And at last it was 7:45, and I was making my bow to a somewhat elderly man with a small bald head and a retreating brow.
"So you're Mr. Raffles' friend,"
he said, overhauling me rather rudely with his light small eyes.
"Seen anything of him?" "Expected him early to show me something, but he's never come."
No more, evidently, had his telegram, and my troubles were beginning early. I said I had not seen Raffles since 1 o'clock, telling the truth with unction while I could. Even as we spoke there came a knock at the door. It was the telegram at last, and after reading it himself the Queenslander handed it to me.
"Called out of town," he grumbled. "Sudden illness of near relative. What near relatives has he got?"
I knew of none, and for an instant I quailed before the perils of invention. Then I replied that I had never met any of his people, and again felt fortified by my veracity.
"Thought you were bosom pals,"
he said, with, as I imagined, a gleam of suspicion in his crafty little eyes. "Only in town," said I. "I've never been to his place."
"Well," he growled, "I suppose it can't be helped. Don't know why he wouldn't come and have his dinner first. Like to see the deathbed I'd go to without my dinner. It's a full-skin billet, if you ask me. Well, must just dine without him. And he'll have to buy his pig in a poke after all. Mind touching that bell? Suppose you know what he came to see me about. Sorry, I shan't see him again, for his own sake. I like Raffles. Took to him amazingly. He's a cynic. Like cynics. One myself. Rank bad form of his mother or his aunt, and I hope she will go and kick the bucket."
I connected these specimens of his conversation, though they were doubtless detached at the time, and interspersed with remarks of mine here and there. They filled the interval until our dinner was served, and they gave me an impression of the man which his every subsequent utterance confirmed. It was an impression which did away with all remorse for my treacherous presence at his table. He was that terrible type, the silly cynic, his aim a caustic commentary on all things and all men, his achievement mere vulgar irreverence and unintelligent scorn. Ill-bred and ill-informed, he had, on his own showing, fluked into fortune on a rise in land. Yet cunning he possessed, as well as malice, and he chuckled until he choked over the misfortunes of less astute spectators in the same boom. Even now I cannot feel much compunction for my behaviour by the Honourable J. M. Craggs, M.L.C. But never shall I forget the private agonies of the situation, the listening to my host with one ear and for Raffles with the other. Once I heard him, though the rooms were not divided by the old-fashioned folding doors, and though the door that did divide them was not only shut but richly curtained, I could have sworn I heard him once. I spilt my wine and laughed at the top of my voice at some coarse sally of my host's, and I heard nothing more, though my ears were on the strain. But later, to my horror, when the waiter had finally withdrawn, Craggs himself sprang up and rushed to his bedroom without a word. I sat like stone till he returned.
"Thought I heard a door go," he said. "Must have been mistaken. Imagination. Gave me quite a turn. Raffles tell you priceless treasure I got in there?"
It was the picture at last. Up to this point I had kept him to Queensland and the making of his pile. I tried to get him back there now, but in vain. He was reminded of his great ill-gotten possession. I said that Raffles had just mentioned it, and that set him off. With the confidential garrulity of a man who has dined too well, he plunged into his darling topic, and I looked past him at the clock. It was only 9:45. In common decency I could not go yet. So there I sat. We were still at port, and learned what had originally fired my host's ambition to possess what he was pleased to call a real, genuine, twin-screw, double-funnelled, copper-bottomed old master. It was to go one better than some rival legislator of pictorial proclivities. But even an epitome of his monologue would be so much weariness. Suffice it that it ended inevitably in the invitation that I had dreaded all the evening.
"But you must see it. Next room, this way."
"Isn't it packed up?" I inquired hastily.
"Lock and key, that's all."
"Pray don't trouble," I urged.
"Trouble be hanged," said he. "Come along."
And all at once I saw that to resist him further would be to heap suspicion upon myself against the moment of impending discovery. I therefore followed him into his bedroom without further protest, and suffered him first to show me the iron map-case which stood in one corner. He took a crafty pride in this receptacle, and I thought he would never cease descanting on its innocent appearance and its Chubb's lock. It seemed an interminable age before the key was in the latter. Then the ward clicked, and my pulse stood still.
"By Jove!"
I cried next instant. The canvas was in its place among the maps.
"Thought it would knock you," said
Craggs, drawing it out and unrolling it for my benefit.
"Grand thing, ain't it? Wouldn't think it had been painted 230 years. It has, though, my word. Old Johnson's face will be a treat when he sees it. Won't go bragging about his pictures much more. Why, this one's worth all the pictures in Colony of Queensland put together. Worth £50,000, my boy, and I got it for 5.
He dug me in the ribs, and seemed in the mood for further confidences. My appearance checked him, and he rubbed his hands.
"If you take it like that," he chuckled, "how will old Johnson take it? Go out and hang himself to his own picture-rods, I hope."
Heaven knows what I contrived to say at last. Struck speechless first by my relief, I continued silent from a very different cause. A new tangle of emotions tied my tongue. Raffles had failed. Raffles had failed! Could I not succeed? Was it too late? Was there no way?
"So long,"
he said, taking a last look at the canvas before he rolled it up.
"So long till we get to Brisbane."
The flutter I was in as he closed the case.
"For the last time,"
he went on, as his keys jingled back into his pocket.
"It goes straight into the strong-room on board."
If I could but send him out to Australia with only its legitimate contents in his precious map-case! If I could but succeed where Raffles had failed! We returned to the other room. I have no notion how long he talked or what about. Whiskey and soda became the order of the hour. I scarcely touched it, but he drank copiously, and before 11 I left him incoherent. And the last train for Esher was the 11:50 out of Waterloo. I took a hansom to my rooms. I was back at the hotel in 13 minutes. I walked upstairs. The corridor was empty. I stood an instant on the sitting-room threshold, heard a snore within, and admitted myself softly with my gentleman's own key, which it had been a very simple matter to take away with me. Craggs never moved. He was stretched on the sofa fast asleep, but not fast enough for me. I saturated my handkerchief with the chloroform I had brought, and laid it gently over his mouth. 2 or 3 stertorous breaths, and the man was a log. I removed the handkerchief. I extracted the keys from his pocket. In less than 5 minutes I put them back, after winding the picture about my body beneath my Inverness cape. I took some whiskey and soda water before I went. The train was easily caught, so easily that I trembled for 10 minutes in my first-class smoking carriage, in terror of every footstep on the platform, in unreasonable terror till the end. Then, at last, I sat back and lit a cigarette, and the lights of Waterloo reeled out behind. Some men were returning from the theatre. I can recall their conversation even now. They were disappointed with the piece they had seen. It was one of the later Savoy operas, and they spoke wistfully of the days of Pinafore and Patience. One of them hummed a stave, and there was an argument as to whether the air was out of Patience or the Mikado. They all got out at Surbiton, and I was alone with my triumph for a few intoxicating minutes. To think that I had succeeded where Raffles had failed! Of all our adventures this was the first in which I had played a commanding part, and of all of them this was infinitely the least discreditable. It left me without a conscience qualm. I had but robbed a robber when all was said, and I had done it myself, single-handed, ipse egomet. I pictured Raffles, his surprise, his delight. He would think a little more of me in future. And that future, it should be different. We had £2,000 apiece, surely enough to start afresh as honest men, and all through me. In a glow I sprang out at Esher, and took the one belated cab that was waiting under the bridge. In a perfect fever I beheld Broom Hall, with the low story still lit up, and saw the front door open as I climbed the steps.
"Thought it was you," said Raffles cheerily. "It's all right. There's a bed for you. Sir Bernard's sitting up to shake your hand."
His good spirits disappointed me, but I knew the man. He was one of those who wear their brightest smile in the blackest hour. I knew him too well by this time to be deceived. "I've got it!" I cried in his ear. "I've got it!"
"Got what?"
he asked me, stepping back. "The picture!"
"What?"
"The picture! He showed it me. You had to go without it. I saw that, so I determined to have it. And here it is!"
"Let's see," said Raffles grimly.
I threw off my cape and unwound the canvas from about my body. While I was doing so, an untidy old gentleman made his appearance in the hall, and stood looking on with raised eyebrows.
"Looks pretty fresh for an old master, doesn't she?" said Raffles.
His tone was strange. I could only suppose that he was jealous of my success. So Craig said. I hardly looked at it myself.
"Well, look now, look closely. By Jove, I must have faked her better than I thought."
"It's a copy?" I cried.
"It's the copy," he answered. "It's the copy I've been tearing all over the country to procure. It's the copy I faked back and front so that on your own showing it imposed upon Craig's, and might have made him happy for life. And you go and rob him of that."
I could not speak.
"How did you manage it?"
inquired Sir Bernard Debenham.
"Have you killed him?"
asked Raffles sardonically. I did not look at him. I turned to Sir Bernard Debenham, and to him I told my story, hoarsely, excitedly, for it was all that I could do to keep from breaking down. But as I spoke I became calmer, and I finished in mere bitterness, with the remark that another time Raffles might tell me what he meant to do.
"Another time?" he cried instantly. "My dear Bunny, you speak as though we are going to turn burglars for a living."
"I trust you won't," said Sir Bernard, smiling, "for you are certainly two very daring young men. Let us hope our friend from Queensland will do as he has said, and not open his map-case till he gets back there. He will find my check awaiting him, and I shall be very much surprised if he troubles any of us again." Raffles and I did not speak till I was in the room which had been prepared for me, nor was I anxious to do so then. But he followed me, and took my hand.
"Bunny," said he, "don't you be hard on a fellow. I was in the deuce of a hurry, and didn't know that I should ever get what I wanted in time, and that's a fact. But it serves me right that you should have gone and undone one of the best things I ever did. As for your handiwork, old chap, you won't mind my saying that I didn't think you had it in you. In future—"
"Don't talk to me about the future," I cried. "I hate the whole thing. I'm going to chuck it up."
"So am I," said Raffles, "when I've made my pile."
End of 9 Points of the Law.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.